Okay, some of what I'll talk about will segue smoothly onto Cheng Pei's talk, so. So the title is All Complicated Things, but what it's really going to do is there will be a model independent part to this, and then there'll be a little bit of a model dependent part toward the end. So there's a whole potpourri and menu here. Since it's California, you mix up your menus from all the styles. So I'll talk about hadron and neutrino shower characteristics because the bounds I'm going to talk about will largely derive from present data on horizontal showers. So we'll have to talk a little bit about shower characteristics for those people who are not familiar with it all. And talk about acceptances and exposures, especially at Agassa and Fly's Eye, which are the only existing experiments. So these will be bounds on existing data. And at some point, we'll devolve into bounds on high energy flux and model independent bounds on new physics. And then finally, there will be some, when you have a model, we can see what happens with the model. And the model I will play with is one that I've been extensively involved with over the last couple of years with a postdoctoral fellow at Northeastern, Louis Anchardocki, and Jonathan Fang and Al Shapir. This paper here contains these some of the stuff in the talk, recent bounds. So we're going to be talking about showers, so let me talk a little bit about shower characteristics and the difference between neutrino showers and hadron showers. So neutrinos have a very long interaction length, so showers are very rare, and you don't get a lot of the altitude dependence that you get with hadron showers, except if you're above the atmosphere. So you shower anywhere and above the detector. So ground-based arrays like Agassa and Auger will be able to deal with this kind of front coming in from both above the detector and to the side of the detector. There will be large electromagnetic components. First of all, if you have a shower that has to do with an electron neutrino, you produce an electron, and that gives you a large electromagnetic component. There will be curved fronts because you're showering deep into the atmosphere, not way, way back, so the front hasn't had a chance to become parallel yet. So there's a measurable curved front, a radius of curvature. And tied in with that is a delay, a signal spread in time. Things are developing deep in the atmosphere, so you actually, even with ground-based arrays, are sensitive to positioning that way. Hadron showers, they shower very high in the atmosphere, so X max is about, the grammage is about 900 grams per square centimeter. Neutrino showers will typically shower above 2,500 grams per square centimeter penetration into the atmosphere. So it's a big difference there. And the other thing is, with ground-based arrays, the electromagnetic component gets damped out rather quickly. That component is visible with fluorescent detectors, but with ground-based array, basically all you see are muons surviving at the ground. And again here, as opposed to this one, there's a flat shower front and there's a short signal. So things are really different characteristically. And in order to avail oneself of data, there's essentially a convolution. The events that you see are a convolution of several things. There is the acceptance of the detector, the area, and so on and so forth, the flux, and the cross-section. So first let me discuss what we call the exposure, which is a convolution of the effective area and the density of the detecting medium, which is air, and over time, and I write as an integral here, because some of the facilities I will be talking about had different exposures during different eras, or epochs, as they call them, of their detection. So it may be a piecewise integral, but it's an integral nonetheless over time, rather than just multiplying by time. And we'll use a standard atmospheric parameterization where the scale is set by 8 kilometers, and we will work up to neutrinos being sensitive up to 15 kilometers. And then we can talk about the effective aperture, this quantity, A omega effective, as a convolution of the actual area and the solid angle with a probability that a shower coming in, developing at an angle theta to the zenith angle theta time t with an energy E of the shower, which will be very important, not the E of the primary, but the E of the shower, this would be called the effective aperture. And theta min and theta max are set by having good acceptance for neutrino showers. So basically they will be, theta min will be of the order of 70 or 80 degrees, so you can develop a long X max, and theta max is dictated by how sensitive the ground array is to this horizontal shower front. So this is the basic, what we call the exposure. And here's some discussion on neutrino exposure for ground arrays. So first of all, for hadronic showers, say, suppose you have a neutral current situation. This is not a hadron, but a neutrino causing a hadronic shower. We get a muon component, that is the electromagnetic component, which gets damped in pure electromagnetic showers, you have a surviving muon component, and this enhances the triggering greatly at ground level. So hadronic acceptance will generally be better than the electromagnetic shower acceptance, which I'll come to in a moment. Now, at higher energies for the shower, this is very, very strange. You might expect that you would go to an article in a paper and somebody would give you the acceptance. Well, that is not available in papers, say, in AGASA, nor is it possible actually to dig it out. This is, you know, often regarded as, by people doing the experiment, perhaps rightly, as their proprietary information to process their data. And what we did was go to some reports that give limits on searches for deeply penetrating showers. There are 1 sigma limits given for the absence of these combined, and these are limits due to nu E showers, and we can combine those limits, and these are limits on showers themselves, and combine those limits with the cross sections to dig out what the acceptance was. So I will show that in the following slide. This is at high energy of the showers. At lower energies, what we did was simply discuss the fact that the AGASA exposure is just reduced by the ratio of surface areas to Auger, and Auger has published their hadronic acceptances. So we took 1/30th of the Auger acceptance. For the electromagnetic shower, we adopted the effective aperture at Auger, reduced by this factor of 30. And when we looked at that, we found that it reproduced AGASA's bounds on the new effluxes which cause electromagnetic showers within 20%. So we were confident that we had extracted the exposure or the acceptance correctly from the Auger data, from the Agassiz data. Now, that was a discussion for ground-based arrays. For fluorescent detectors, things are much more similar because fluorescent detectors see the shower, you're not dependent on this muon remnant and so on, you see the shower along the whole array. Basically, everything lands up electromagnetic because all these pi plus or minuses that are produced in the shower just interact, they cascade and cause more showering, and you have a big electromagnetic component, and the decay component is left in the muons after they've interacted many times. And we adopted the fly's eye exposure over several periods, five running periods, as reported in this data, over a 9-year period. So I will show all these things in a graph, but this is what we did. And this allows us to enhance the, often in terms of limits, only the first epoch of the fly's eye data is used, but taking all these five running periods, we enhance the exposure by a factor of 3. So all of this leads to the following figure, is encapsulated in the following figure. Here's Agassiz hadronic, and here's Agassiz electromagnetic, and this is the fly's eye. This is fly's eye electromagnetic, all electromagnetic, and this is the Agassiz electromagnetic. And over here, when you reach these high energies, you reach a saturation. You do not add the exposures. It's not double. So what one should really have is a continuity where there's a single exposure, and that's what we did up at these high energies. You cannot tell at those highest energies. You don't have a difference between electromagnetic acceptance and hadronic acceptance. Everything saturates. So these are exposures over a whole range of energies up to 10 to the 20th electron volts. Now, if we're going to get some bounds, we're going to base it on existing data. So this is not projections for Auger. This is what has been reported. And what Agassiz reported a number of years ago is they looked for quasi-horizontal showers with X max larger than 2,500 grams per square centimeter. And they determined, this is rather difficult to determine, but taking their determinations, they determine X max for these horizontal showers in two ways. There's a lateral, there's the curvature way that I talked to you about that gives you some information on where the shower primarily was formed. And also, there's a distribution of charge particles, which you can Monte Carlo for different X maxes, and you develop kind of an anatomy of showers reflecting that X max. So there were two determinations, and they looked for showers that exceeded 2,500 grams per square centimeters in each of those two determinations. And the expected background that they reported was 1.72 events, and there was only one event with X max clearly above 2,500 grams per square centimeters in both ways. Fly's eye does things differently. They have a three-parameter fit to charge particle density, and one of the parameters is X max, and then there are two others. They go through their events. Over 11 years of these various exposures and epochs of exposure, and there were no neutrino candidates. And then, so if you combine these two things and look up Feldman and Cousins, you find that there's an upper bound of 3.5 neutrino events at 95% confidence level. Now, armed with that upper bound, we can then start placing limits on various quantities. So here's the working equation for obtaining bounds. The number of events is equal to this convolution of a flux and a cross section and an exposure. So that's the integrated number of events for some period of time. I is the incident neutrino species, and X is some final state. And we're summing over everything here. And these are differential fluxes and so on. So this all gets integrated. And now we have to, the exposures that we gave, if you recall, were in terms of shower energy, not primary energy. So for standard model processes, you one can calculate this, that about 20% of the energy goes into hadronic recoil. So for instance, if you have a muon, a new mu goes to mu plus x, the shower energy is equal to 0.2 of the primary energy, and the acceptance or the exposure is the hadronic one rather than the electromagnetic one, because the mu that's produced doesn't shower, and the hadronic shower is the one that's formed from the remnant of the 20% of the energy. For electron neutrino, it's more complicated, because there's 20% of the energy goes hadronic, and 80% of the energy goes electromagnetic, and you have to add these, but you must be careful not to exceed the saturation exposure, which you can't double things up at the upper end. So, so for AGASA, for charge current examples, we have that. For neutral current, everything is like this. For fly's eye, things are really different. There's only one exposure. It's all electromagnetic. And for nu e, you get the whole energy. For nu mu, you get 0.2. And for tau, I didn't write it. And for anti-electrons and anti-neutrinos, it's all the same. So these are the energies we put into those exposures. And the first thing I'm going to do is how to obtain model-independent local bounds, which means a bound on the on neutrino flux at a particular energy. So energy by energy bin. And so if we have an integrated counting rate that is less than 3.5, it's true for any energy bin trivially. So that's fine. And now we choose our averaging in the following way. We choose a logarithmic interval in energy which is small enough in that interval such that this quantity has a power law behavior in that interval with some unknown power alpha, so that this is a fair representation of this product of cross-section flux and exposure. And this is always true for a small enough interval, but we want the kind of the biggest interval where that will hold true. If that power law behavior holds, we can integrate over that region and find, and this is a very simple thing to show, just algebra, that this integral is equal to the central values of these quantities in that interval times the sinh of this thing over delta times the logarithmic interval delta. And since this thing is greater than 1, cinch delta over delta, we find that you get a conservative local bound that this quantity is less than 3.5 over the logarithmic interval. Now, what do you choose for this logarithmic interval? Looking at the exposures that we have in cross sections, of course, the flux we don't know, but assuming the flux is reasonably smooth, we take delta equal 1, namely 1 e-folding, and that seems safe enough. And we assume total mixing of neutrinos, so we talk in terms of a total neutrino flux, and that's, of course, subject to models of where neutrinos are coming from and all the rest, but this seems safe enough. This includes antineutrinos. And now we use the standard model cross-section to obtain a model-independent local upper bound on the total neutrino flux at 95% confidence level. We can also pass on to a more, as we go from most general to a more global situation, we can assume particular flux behavior and find bounds on that, and that, of course, is on the integrated situation. So, for instance, we will choose a flux like this, a power law with, say, gamma equal 1 or 2, which is often used as an injection primary flux. And that way we can integrate and obtain bounds over the entire range of energy. So here is a graphical summary of these bounds that we find. So let me spend just a little bit of time on this. So these objects here are model-independent bounds. Now, just for reference sake, this flux here is what's known as the Prothero-Johnson flux. Now, the Prothero-Johnson flux is what is also called the cosmogenic flux, and it's basically almost guaranteed. Namely, what you do is you want to inject the power spectrum that will have protons hitting the cosmic microwave background and producing, in effect, being produced, that you produce your neutrinos through collisions of the protons with the cosmic microwave background. And that process is almost certainly present, and this is one, there are a couple of parameters possible here, the evolution of the sources and so on, but this is a fairly conservative minimum value of this flux, and it agrees with subsequent normalizations. So our local bounds are way above that. It's interesting that they agree, they're right on top of the Rice value, and I will explain what Rice is in a moment. These are showers in the Antarctic ice cap. But this assumes a power law, and our local bounds sit on top of that. Chung-Pei was asked about glue measurements. Here are the glue measurements, the lunar profile, the lunar skimming neutrino showers, and they're up here. This point here is the required flux for Z-bursts in one particular calculation of Fodor, Katz, and Ringwald, working on Tom's model. And for this particular calculation, the flux required lies here. This is outside of our realm of possibility. We don't go to 10 to the 21. But, you know, one can read that with whatever way one wants to. This is interesting because these are the two power laws. So if you assume a single power law for the flux over the whole region, this is 1.5 and this is 2, one finds values that are not far above the Prothero-Johnson flux. So if... Yes. These are the 95% confidence level upper limits on the flux from the existing lack of horizontal showers. So these fluxes improve by a factor of factor almost an order of magnitude, or factor 8 or so, over fluxes by Siegel, Alinto, and Tyler. And because they use larger exposures, we use larger exposures, and we use an injection mechanism that is slightly different from theirs for the primaries. Let me just explain briefly these Rice and Glue, which are important for limiting flux. So this is the radioiced Cherenkov experiment, and you get radio pulses from EM showers, Peter Gorham and co-workers. And this is the Goldstone Lunar experiment, where you look for Cherenkov pulses from EM showers in the moon's rim. And these are very, very nice imaginative efforts, not imaginary, but imaginative efforts for getting fluxes. Now, we can go back to our equation and get bounds on cross-sections. So this is bounds on new physics. So here, what we do is go the other way. We assume the Prothero-Johnson flux, and we input, say, a nucleon spectrum, e to the minus 2. We cut off the energy and have a source evolution of this sort. Source evolution of 1 plus z cubed is simply geometric. This implies that you populate your sources more highly in early days. And with standard model cross-section, you have an expected event rate of 0.02 per year at these facilities. And here are the list. One can read it. We can all read it. We're working in models of new physics, which is flavor blind. So we take out the cross sections with this subscript I, and we'll illustrate with two cases for new physics. These are two important cases discussed in recent years, the last couple of years. One is where you have all of the energy going into the shower. So, for instance, black hole production, or anything that converts the entire primary energy into a shower in the center of mass. And the second case is where you have some kind of leading particle effect, and this is kind of thing has been discussed and calculated by Kosterlereis and Plumacher, where as an adjunct of these higher dimensional theories, you have a whole set of Kaluza-Klein gravitons, and you exchange those, and you have an effective neutral current event, except when you calculate the inelasticity, it's even lower than it is for standard model physics. There we had 20% of the energy going into the shower. Here we only have 10% of the energy going into the shower. And so now we go back to our equation. It's the same thing. This is a model-independent condition on the cross-section, averaged on an E-folding. But now we put in the Prothero-Johnson flux, use our exposures, and these are upper limits on cross-sections from unknown model-independent sources. So, for instance, here we have an upper limit. This is in picobarn, so we have an upper limit of 10 to the 8th picobarns on these Kaluza or neutral current type events scattering. This one is for not black holes, there's nothing about black holes here, but for totally inelastic scattering events. Here I specialize to a black hole production. I'll talk about that in the remaining 5-10 minutes, but if you have a model as detailed as black hole production, for instance, this is for 7 extra dimensions and for black hole masses about 5 times the fundamental scale, you get an upper limit on the cross section of this amount. And here a standard model cross section, charge current, neutral current cross sections. No, these are data. These lines are known cross sections.
The black line
is the upper limit on a black hole, on a cross section for production of black holes in 7 extra dimensions for a fundamental scale 1.1 TeV and so on. So this is an upper limit for that. Once you have an upper limit, you can say something about the parameters of the theory, and I'll get to that now. So as you can see, you never approach, let's say, 10 to the 8th picobarns is minus 2 millibarns or something like that. I mean, you never approach anything hadronic here. You cannot deal with that. Except I must say one caveat. This is true for horizontal showers that penetrate. If the cross-section is big enough, we have no limits because those things will look like hadronic showers, and our limits were not based on hadronic showers. They were based on things that don't look hadronic. So there's a window above which we cannot place any limits. So it's not fair to say we've excluded hadronic cross-sections. We don't have anything to say about that. Okay. Yeah. I'll show you that soon. Okay. So just as a short comparison to previous bounds, we have an updated exposure, and we gain a factor of 9. We use a slightly bigger cutoff energy at the source. These authors used a cutoff energy, which is the cutoff energy for the cosmic rays themselves. It seemed to us much too conservative to take a cutoff at the source, which is exactly the cutoff that one sees in cosmic rays themselves. We adopted 95% confidence limit, so we lose a factor of 4 here in our limits. So we get a net improvement of about an order of magnitude. Okay, now in the remaining time, let me sketch briefly this idea of extra dimensions. So I'll give some up-to-date bounds on that. We worked out some bounds a few years ago, and these are more up-to-date bounds with the new exposures. So the general idea is probably familiar to everybody that our four-dimension, we live on a brain with 3 spatial and 1 time, and we share the time dimension with everybody. Nobody's gone that daringly to adopt a new time dimension. I don't think that works too well. And for the purposes of this discussion, I will just use the standard idea that n of these, that there are a total of 4 plus n dimensions, and n of these little ones just curl up and become compact. And when you do the integral in the vial action and integrate out these extra dimensions, you find that the Planck scale that we know and love is related to a fundamental d-dimensional Planck scale in this manner through this radius r. And then, of course, there was raised by couple of years ago the idea that r is large enough so that the fundamental Planck scale is actually at around a TeV, and everybody will be happy because there's an awful lot to discover at that point. So, now, the implications are, the first striking implication was that there was a whole tower of massive gravitons, this Kaluza-Klein tower, and that had lots of implications for scattering, for detection, for missing momentum events at various accelerators. Bounds have been put on this MD in various ways. For instance, Newtonian gravity is good down to 0.2 millimeters, and so for n equal 1, you get a bound of MD larger than 5,000 TeV, which makes the whole thing uninteresting. In astrophysics, there are bounds on cooling by emission of all these KK gravitons. In order to not cool, have too rapid supernova cooling for the given time curves that one observes, you limit n equal to 2 or 3 by these amounts. So in effect, you can you can basically rule out n equal 1 for low level gravity. You can almost rule out n equal 2 and 3 for these kind of flat theories, that is, curling up on the straight toroidal compactification. But I have to say one thing with respect to this, that if you have a model like another model that was done by Randall Sundrum, then you can have none of these bounds hold. You do not have light KK gravitons. They are more like TeV scale, and you lose these kinds of bounds. And then any number of extra dimensions is okay, as long as the whatever phenomena you're looking at is small compared to the curvature of the anti-de Sitter space that sits in these models. So I will present cross-sections even for these low values of n, with the caveat that they have to be in Randall Sundrum theories rather than these theories. Accelerator experiments limit Tevatron. You get anomalous four-point interactions, and these are some limits of a few years ago. Recently, there were limits from monojets analyzed from Tevatron, and one gets limits that are akin to the LEP limits of about 600-800 GeV for the fundamental scale. And then there was the exciting proposal that the collapse that in TeV scale collisions, you would form black holes in this extended space. And there's a whole list of authors. What was also discussed in a very fine paper by M. Perron, Horowitz, and Myers is that these evaporate primarily to standard model particles. The phase space for extra gravitons is much suppressed at lower momenta of the gravitons, and it compensates for the fact that there are many of them. So we should see a whole burst of standard model particles formed after this black hole forms. There are arguments why the cross-section is geometric. I won't go into those. And this is the Schwarzschild radius. And you can calculate, you can initiate horizontal showers way above the standard model rate, factors of 10 and 100 above the standard model rate, through neutrino scattering on air, giving a black hole. And you go ahead and calculate this. Now, the cross-section depends greatly on this quantity X min, which is the minimum black hole mass divided by MD. And this quantity X min is also related to the whole validity of the classical discussion, the semi-classical discussion. Namely, if X min decides the entropy, and you want a big enough entropy in order to be able to talk about an object that evaporates and radiates in a Hawking manner. So we have to adopt a lower limit here, say X min equal 3, for validity of a classical or semi-classical discussion. Here are some sample cross-sections. Here's a standard model one. And here you see, for all kinds of values, X min equal 1, 3, N equal 1 to 7. You don't have to concentrate on this. But generally speaking, one sees that in the region of 10 to the of E nu equal 10 to the 19th EV, you get about a factor of 100 difference in rates between standard model and black hole production. So that plays into obtaining So what we can do is repeat the discussion of before. So for each, we have the total exposure. We take the cosmogenic flux, and the cross-section, we get expected event rates for different values of X min and MD. So it's a full two-dimensional space. But once we require that we get bounded by the previous bounds at 95 CL of the data, we determine lower bounds on MD for each X min. So you limit that two-dimensional space. And that is what is done here. Here we have the standard model curves. Here is again this curve, and you know, here we get these bounds. So this is and can combine all that with an exclusion plot. This is perhaps the clearest way to present the data. So, say for x min equal 3, the upper bound, one gets that the lower bound on MD is equal to 1.3 here, in order not to violate these bound, the horizontal shower bounds from before. So for each value of x min, you buy yourself a lower bound on MD. And now these bounds actually are the best bounds there are. You know, once one believes this model, these are the best bounds on MD that exist. The Fermilab ones, as I said, are of order a little less than a TeV. But there are uncertainties, but they really do allow you to... So here's a comparison with D0 bounds. They're anomalous four-point functions. You get QQ bar goes to gamma gamma or EE through an S-channel graviton. They generate effective four-point functions. However, you have to sum over the entire array of these KK gravitons, and that sum diverges. You have to put a cutoff. The cutoff is, in effect, what is called a brain softening factor. By the time you're through with this, it's very obvious. That, in effect, these there's the energies of these gravitons are in the higher dimensional space, and as they leave the brain, there is a recoil. No structure can be rigid in quantum field theory or in string theory, so there is a form factor on emission of the gravitons from our brain, our three-dimensional brain. And this typical form factor should be smaller than MD. So here's a sample of the Tevatron limits translated into lower limits on MD as opposed to just data. And say for lambda over MD equal 0.9, typically you get bounds that are a little less than the ones we have, but comparable. This is... Okay. Again, this is the Tevatron bounds are only for flat because they involve the whole summation of KK and so on. Bounds from Tevatron on Randall syndrome were obtained separately by Tom Rizzo and I always forget the name of his co-author. Daviasl? Okay, sorry, I don't have it straight. Daviasl. Okay, so let me summarize. So from existing limits, we've obtained bounds on cosmic ray neutrino flux, which are significantly stronger than existing limits. One thing I didn't mention is that there are constraints on these top-down models. One popular model of high-energy cosmic rays is that you have these relics from some supermassive era or topological defects that decay, and they're decaying rather locally, so you don't have to worry about the... and especially they form neutrinos here. And... And typically, if you try to match the, from these models, if you try to match the existing cosmic ray flux, shower flux or cosmic ray flux to these models, you will typically greatly exceed our bounds on neutrinos. I haven't presented all that here, but it's a severe limitation on these models. And then we obtain bounds on cross sections, and finally we consider TeV scale gravity models and get lower limits on the fundamental Planck scale. And they're rather very good limits compared to existing ones. Thanks. I don't think we can do that because they're really. Oh, if you use the power law, we can't do our. I don't think we've done that with the power law. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know the answer right now to that. Check, that's a good thing to check. Yeah.
With OJ, the aperture, the exposure would be 30 times what we use for a vessel.
Yeah.
So presumably your bound would be 30 times better.
Yep.
And then we use it about another factor of 30.
Yep.
So the best is yet to come. The
best is yet to come, yeah. That's right. Yeah, it does absolutely scales with the exposure. So it's the area and then the running time as well, so the whole thing. But presumably that will also be considerably bigger given the investment. So one should, I figure two orders of magnitude. That's right. Yep. Of course, I don't know, you know, one hasn't, the Monte Carlos aren't in yet for Auger with horizontal showers, and we'll wait and see. But if things move geometrically as in this way, it should be okay. Yeah.
Thank you.